This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A Ken doctor tracks the health of newspapers and other local news outlets in this country. He pays attention to the economic trends, and he's documented this decline in local news over the last 10 years. This is an industry that's been hit hard by the digital revolution, the Great Recession, and now in this new reality of this coronavirus pandemic, doctor says words like decline and deterioration have changed to annihilation and extinction. And he points out the irony of the situation. At a time when people are more interested than ever in local news, the number of cases, the updates, the briefings, some newspapers or weeklies are just not going to be able to withstand what seems to be a coming depression. And in that way, it's not unlike the restaurants or shops in your community. So today in the program, we wanted to talk about what happens to a place when you don't have local journalists to report and investigate and hold leaders accountable. And how has the pandemic changed an already uncertain future? Before we get to the analysis, though, we wanted to get an on-the-ground view. Joining us on the program is John Saltis. He's the founder and publisher of the alternative weekly newspaper Salt Lake City Weekly. And we began by talking about when Saltis knew things were going to get bad.
We were all cautiously watching, as everybody was. It's an eventual pandemic. Everyone was nervous. What does this mean? And then the city of Austin shut down South by Southwest. And it was founded by our friends, Nick Barbaro, Lewis Black. And when it was shut down, I knew my buddies were getting, you know, kicked around pretty good, and they were going to take a big hit. That's where it began for us. But what immediately happened was it sent a tidal wave through the whole event and entertainment category. So right away, people started to back off of like, we might not have a concert in June or July or May. And so when that happened on that scale, we knew, everybody knew. It was pretty obvious this was going to be tough.
John, aren't you always on the edge anyway? Like, aren't you always worried anyway in this new era of, you know, digital technology and online technology? Aren't you always feeling disoriented anyway?
Oh, yeah. And it became more of a point for us, of course, the last 4 or 5 years, but as people started to move their advertising budgets to online. It began with classifieds and migrated to other categories of businesses that would suddenly feel like a Facebook post was as valuable as an ad in a newspaper or a radio spot. It's not, but that's what people began to think because of the storytelling that went behind it. You know, tech is king. So we've been feeling it for a long time, watching it and finding our ways through it, by the way. We survived all the closures. We survived most of the cutbacks. And we had developed and morphed into a different kind of company, not just a newspaper, but a media company. But so we were coming through and looking at 2020 as the cusp of a new era for us. Mm-hmm. And right when it was going to happen is when it hit the fan. And it hit hard because we lost March, and March was going to, budget-wise and planning-wise, was going to be a big month for us, and then also continuation into the rest of 2020, just to be the way we would go forward was starting in March. It never had the chance to happen.
Why did you get into this in the first place?
Well, I graduated with a journalism degree, and in that era, there was really nowhere to go. You worked for a daily newspaper or you didn't. And Utah only had one other magazine at the time. It was called Utah Holiday, I believe. Mm-hmm. So there was really not much room in this market if you wanted to be a reporter. And by the way, I didn't want to be a reporter. I just don't like that stuff. I don't like running into a car accident scene and reporting. I like telling or storytelling or opinion. Those are what I prefer as a journalist. Those were the things that drew me. But no one would have expressed that here either. I moved to Chicago in the early 80s. I lived there. I saw the first alternative newspaper I'd ever seen called the Chicago Reader. And it was full of the kind of stuff I liked. Quirky, off the wall, off track, strong opinion, funny, clever, long stories, storytelling. All that was all in one package. And I said, I want to do that too. And a couple of years later, moved back to Salt Lake City and started City Weekly. Hmm. In this market, there was a void that never was filled, and mostly because clubs and at least at that time, clubs could not advertise at all, right? So there was no revenue model that would support one, and there was no distribution model that would support it. We began as a newsletter.
Give me a sense of what you think a magazine like yours does for a community in particular. I mean, beyond just giving out the news, what are the other elements? Offering a critical voice comes to mind, a kind of gathering place.
Counterpoint, a perspective that others are not stating, a voice for more or less disenfranchised people that have no voice. Those are the vocal things. But they're also, and when you think of a community, and we're not fencing ourselves in and saying this is our community, no one can come in. It's kind of open border. So people come and go within that community all the time and share that commonality. And what you find when you're in a community, and we all do, whether it's community of neighbors or community like in a family, you find comfort. So what we found since the first part of COVID is we're not just for the news. We're that institutional thing in a way that makes people feel good just knowing that it's there. That's been part of my personal reason to keep things going, is because I know there's a dependency, not just on the news, not just some, because, you know, there's plenty of news in town, right? And it's not just that. It is that it's a community, and it's a, you know, you don't want to see the sign go down. It's a vital part where it makes people find comfort right now, because people do need their institutions right now, do need to trust them, do need to know that their friends are with them.
Wait, what to say something more about that. I liked what you said. That seems like a kind of really powerful thing to say. We don't want to see the sign come down.
Yeah, I mean, it's when the neighbor changes. Suddenly there's a fence around the property you used to play on. You don't feel good any longer. When the part of one of our life cultures goes from pasture to a hard cement parking lot or building, it's a change that we're not comfortable with. And when something goes away, we feel part of our loss. This is something I grew up with. I grew up in Bingham Canyon. And for the entirety of my young life, I saw, you know, the bank and then the post office and then the city hall and then the hospital and the doctor's clinic and all those buildings being torn down as the Kennecott mine expanded throughout the canyon. So every one of those was a piece of me that I'll never see again, never get back. It's incredibly disconcerting to know you can't touch the ground you grew up on. It's gone, it's a hole, or it's buried. So I'm kind of sensitive to things going away. And I know how they impact people.
What difference has it made that there's been a City Weekly? What difference do you think you've made?
There's two ways to answer that. And one is the long route, and I could go like back in whatever year it was in the very, very old offices when I wrote a little political column one time that resulted in Sheriff Aaron Kennard being elected. That little thing way back then, we've done over and over and over again. Changed a mayor in West Jordan. It changed the politics of our city. Those kinds of things are the you maybe hang a hat on. But I always go back, instead of trying to delineate what did we make better, is what people ask us all the time. And for example, this morning somebody sent a $50 check as a donation. And the phrase on it was, I can't imagine Salt Lake City without City Weekly. Please survive. That's the way I would almost rather answer that, is that you've all been here. What would Salt Lake look like without City Weekly? It wouldn't have Main Street the way it is right now, because we're the ones that helped move the needle on having more than one club or liquor outlet on the facing block. Governor Huntsman, when he was governor, acknowledged myself and Tom Barberi at a signature when we got rid of private clubs in Utah. Without changing the culture of Utah, you might not have Silicon Slopes. I'm not taking credit for it. What I'm saying is we did make the changes that other things happened that they don't look like we did it directly, but we had a big role to play in it. So the answer to me is, where would we be without City Weekly?
Let me ask you, John, finally, I guess a question that we could ask of a shop owner or a restaurant owner or someone who has a small business. How long do you figure you can hold out?
We've cut staff to the point where even with all the cuts, it's almost impossible to survive, even though we've been fortunate because our community has backed us thus far to a sufficient degree to just kind of turn the wheels. But there's lots of bills that don't get paid, and there's situational things we have to deal with every day. But we are lucky that there have been a few people of, you know, high caliber stand up. Hey, we've got to help City Weekly because they've helped us, and they're buying ads even though their doors are shut. And you can see that in our paper. And they're saying, hey, we're with you, but we're also telling the people that are out there, we'll be back. Now, the problem for us and for them is the hospitality industry was the first hit and will be the slowest to recover. Events even worse, because who wants to, who until we all know or have a vaccine is going to want to get into a packed arena, you know, yeah, other than watching WWE in Florida because it's an essential business, you know, but who among us? It's one thing to go fly fishing up on the Duchesne. It's another thing to go, you know, to a regatta with thousands of people on the beach. It's not going to happen overnight. You know, we're selling hand sanitizer with Ogden's own distillery up in Ogden and moving that into people's hands now. So not only have we been able to generate a few more dollars of revenue, but we also feel good because it's a product that's helping people right now. That's something City Weekly's always done. It's made somebody feel better, and that feels good.
John Saltis, good luck. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug.
John Saltis, he's the founder and publisher of the alternative weekly newspaper, Salt Lake City Weekly. Joining us now on the program is Ken Doctor. He's a news industry analyst, the author of Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News. And Doctor says this pandemic has shown us the value of local news in ways few stories could.
It's clearly a global story, and it's clearly a national story, and people can be glued to CNN or read the New York Times or the Washington Post. But what they care about is my hospital going to be overloaded? How bad is the problem here? Is there a grocery store that is delivering, and does it have COVID?
Yeah.
All of these questions are uniquely local. CNN, New York Times are never going to answer these questions. And, of course, it isn't a 1 or 3 day thing like a tornado story or an earthquake story. It is an ongoing crisis. So we've seen reproven the necessity of local news and consequently the amount of traffic, digital traffic on local news sites that are doing a good job has been great. It's essentially doubled the first month and doubled rapt attention, people wanting the local information in addition to what they were getting nationally. And clearly, the need for local news and really good experienced local news has never been shown to be greater than this crisis.
I guess there's a kind of a, I think you've described it as this terrible irony going on. And there are these different converging forces. On one hand, as you say, local news seems more valuable than it ever has right now. And then on the other hand, the other force at play is this collapse of advertising, which gives us this weird irony that we're confronting.
Absolutely. And anybody that grew up in the 20th century and the early part of this century, you know, you assumed that it was advertising that would pay for newspapers. But it's not ordained anywhere. It just was such a great business for so long with profit margins of 25-30%. That people said, well, yeah, it's the advertisers, it's the grocery stores and the furniture stores and the car dealers that are putting all the ads in, and it works perfectly. I get a newspaper for cheap, and they're putting ads in. The internet changed all that with essentially $35 billion a year in advertising and daily newspapers going out the window and largely going into the coffers of Google and Facebook. But that doesn't mean that's the only way it could be. And luckily, we now have really good examples from New York Times and Washington Post nationally, but also Boston Globe, Star Tribune in Minneapolis, Seattle Times, the LA Times, of strong, independent local newspapers that are getting more and more reader support, and to the point where reader support through subscriptions is becoming the number one source of revenue, and advertising can still be important, but it's number two. So that's the revolution that's been going on slowly, but then there are some really good examples of it. It's just that there are too few examples of it.
Can readers' support be the thing that turns it around? And can I just add listener support in there too? I want to fold the idea of public radio journalism into this mix if we can as well, because it seems apt, at least in some circumstances here.
It's very apt, and I cover public radio not as much as I like to, just because of time constraints. But the mission of public radio in cities and stations like yours that have committed to more news programming, the mission is the most closely aligned to the traditional mission of newspapers, which is to serve the public without fear or favor. And so there is, if you look at this landscape of local news, public radio stations in the larger cities, largely top 25, 30, 35 cities that have made a commitment to news have also gotten more listener support through membership. So it's the same thing. And you're right. And whether it's listener membership or reader subscription, it's the same thing. And what does public radio do? You get underwriting, which is advertising, which is a strong support as well, but you're not dependent on it. And you want to be more dependent on the people who are actually enjoying and appreciating the product, which are the listeners or the readers.
You mentioned in one of your pieces recently how you have this core of local journalists working kind of on this knife's edge. I mean, they're doing all of this critical reporting, all the while you say they're wondering just how long they'll have a job. How close are the margins here for some of these news organizations and these local news organizations in the country?
Well, most immediately in the second quarter of this year with our near total shutdown, a lot of newspapers have had reduced profits, but they've been profitable. 90% plus of American dailies have been profitable, even with all of the woes that we know that they have. But when advertising essentially has been cut in half, 30 to 60% cuts in advertising in April, we can expect most of that to continue into May. They are actually, on an operational basis, they will be unprofitable. So this is a line that they're crossing that, of course, they don't want to cross. And it's pushing in some familiar directions, and it's going to push in some new directions. We've seen a lot of consolidation, essentially financial consolidation. We're going to see more. Does that save costs? And a lot of these papers that have still published in print 7 days a week are starting to cut back to 5 days a week or 2 days of print. So we will see that. That could be a good cost-cutting move. It could also be a faster route toward suicide.
One news executive told you that this may be our last chance to prove how valuable we are.
Yeah.
What did that person mean?
Meaning that the pre-COVID, the walls have been closing in financially on the business, and some people are just basically making it through, hoping to get digital enough with enough reader revenue fast enough that they could survive and keep a well-sized, experienced newsroom. Now, this is a chance both to prove essentiality, but also it is an existential test for them. Can they make it through as a business? Can they make it through? And some won't.
You say our language has changed. This was interesting. It used to be we would say decline, deterioration.
Right.
Now we're on to these really big, scary words like annihilation and extinction.
Yeah.
Are those a little overwrought, or are we really at a point where they apply in some ways?
Well, if you own a newspaper and it is publishing one day and the next it's not, that's an extinction event, right?
Yeah.
For that newspaper, mm-hmm. Right? And so it isn't too strong in that way. What is more troubling, though, but harder for people to get their heads around, is it isn't a black or white, you could use an old newspaper metaphor, question of is there a newspaper or is there not? It's how much actual reporting, original reporting, is in that vehicle, whether it's print or digital, that's getting to any community, and can the community act on that reporting? And by that standard, there's still a lot of papers that are publishing with a nameplate that's in black letter and 100 years old, but have so little news in them.
Yeah.
That's the bigger problem.
Yeah, that gets us to this idea of ghost news organization, ghost papers, right? They still exist, but they're skeletal. They can't get to the meetings they used to be able to get to. You don't have reporters who have the luxury of having institutional knowledge and working a beat day after day after day, those kinds of dynamics aren't in place, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with the ownership changes you've gone through with the Salt Lake Tribune, you know, that was a digital first paper. It's called MNG Enterprises, all kinds of names for that parent company. That company has been the most rapacious of the cutting kinds of companies. And in fact, there is one paper back in the East in Pennsylvania where they're down to one reporter, and that reporter is covering 14 agencies.
Wow.
And you put covering in quotes, of course, because no human being could do it. But you have this all over the country where meetings are not being covered. Even in Cleveland, a big city, they basically said, well, we're not going to cover actually government the way we used to, meaning we're not going to go to the meetings. Now, meeting stories may be boring often, but unless you go to the meetings, you can't tell the public how its money is being spent. And so this is the basic purpose of newspapers that we're seeing go out the window.
I keep looking for silver linings in all of this. I think everyone is, you know, during these times.
Sure.
One of the things you mentioned is that a story like this one, the coronavirus, has gotten journalists feeling, you say, most connected to that sense of mission that first got them into this line of work in the first place.
Absolutely.
Explain that.
So it's hard to be a journalist knowing that you're in what is a quote unquote a dying trade. Now, it's not dying for lack of people's interest. It's dying because the business model has changed. Yeah. But humans being humans, and reporters are humans, they know that they may not have the esteem. And people say, oh, I hear what's terrible, what's happening at your paper. And, you know, it's, what they want to hear is, wow, that was a great story. That was a great story you did. Now, in this crisis, it is amazing the way so many editors and reporters and visual people have risen to the occasion and have gone and sometimes put themselves in peril to really try to explain to their communities what is going on, the people behind the scenes, the nurses and doctors, the people feeding homeless people. So you get that sense of what is going on and also some critical reporting. How come my county is behind? How come my state is behind on its policies or its testing policies at this point? Now, journalists, now the silver lining is really there, and it is in front of us. The question is a matter of time at this point, because what we talked about with listener support and reader support is doubly important. Obviously, first, it's money, and people need to be paid to do their professional work. People in public radio that I've talked to over the years, they feel valued. You're connected to your audiences, especially human voice is a much warmer medium than print often. But you know that and you feel stable. What we do see is in this whole reader revenue revolution, which is only 10 years old, led by the New York Times, is that journalists, when they see readers actually buying more subscriptions, as they have during this COVID crisis, they say, like, people appreciate us.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the old Sally Field line, you know, they really like us.
Yeah.
And so they get that. And so it is an affirmation expressed through subscription or membership, but it is an affirmation of the value of the work. And so it's there. There just needs to be more of it.
There's this really good, I have to say, I thought it was a really good sign that you mentioned in your writing, how a lot of people these days are not waiting. You know, when they go online to a newspaper, they're not subscribed, at least at first. They're not waiting for all those free articles to expire. They're not waiting to hit the paywall. We seem to be seeing people acting right more than they had in the past, getting a subscription, getting a digital subscription, not waiting. And that seems like a trend or at least a good sign, right?
It's a very good sign, and it's a sign. It's funny. A newspaper publisher told me that, and he was thrilled by it because it was an affirmation for him. But what it also shows is that the reading public's not ignorant out there. There's a lot of people in the reading and listening public who understand the value of well done news in a democracy. And just they need to be reminded of that. So this COVID crisis has reminded them of that. And that's why instead of waiting to hit a paywall, some people subscribed a lot, you know, a lot more people subscribe. And the economics of this are interesting. You don't need 50% of all the people that hit a news site to become a member. In public radio, it's only about 10% of the listeners become. And I would always urge those who are not to become members and to subscribe to the press that they believe in. But it doesn't take a majority. It takes 10% in public radio, and it can be 3 to 5% of all of the unique visitors that might hit a newspaper website in a month to make it successful. So if people individually are seeing the value in that, that's really important. The trend is there. The apparatus is there with reader revenue. We just need it to be essentially in a lot of places doubled or tripled, which is not an impossible number. But that's the arithmetic of the time.
Do you think there's some movement then away from what seemed to be, and you and I have talked about this in the past, that we had an opportunity early on in the internet age when we could have established paywalls, we could have established journalistic organizations being paid for their work, but somehow we opted for the idea of free. We came into this kind of free culture. And I'm wondering if you're seeing this trend reversing now, this culture of expecting information to be free, changing a little bit, people realizing the value of these kinds of things and having to pay for it if it's going to be there.
I think it's changed a lot. I mean, it's changed in our lives generally. You remember Napster and free music and, you know, pirated films and all this kind of stuff. And holy proclamations, not only early on that the world, you know, the internet wants to be free, but beyond that, nobody would ever pay for content. Or those young people, usually those we like to blame, those young people will never pay for content, right? And now Netflix, I think, is up to 160 million subscriptions around the world. The subscription economy is huge. And the world is kind of back to normal. People will pay for what they value. Is it a good enough value proposition on the one hand? Am I getting enough movies? Am I getting enough TV shows? Am I getting enough news? And what local media, both newspapers and public radio, share is they can offer a twofold offer to people. We will give you something of real value. We're giving you value all through the day for radio and daily for newspapers or through the day as well. And in addition, we're here to make this community a better place and help you make it a better place. So there's both an argument that's essentially transactional. When we deal with Netflix, it's transactional. We give them some money, $11 a month, and we get what we think is an unlimited supply of movies. It's not, but it's a pretty good supply.
Yeah.
But locally, we get a really good supply of news or music or whatever people are getting. And we are supporting a unique community institution. I think that in those places where either it's stations or newspapers or both that are supplying a good enough level of product and are really doing what they can to promote community betterment, getting people more involved, they're getting rewarded. And as I'm saying, it is a really good model. It just needs to grow a lot faster given the decline of the traditional business.
But what did COVID do for all of that? It seems like there was this trend headed in a way that seemed to be pretty positive. And then we all got nailed with this. One of the news executives you talked to said, if it's a couple months, we'll make it through. If it's 6 months, all bets are off. So how did the coronavirus change the trajectory of this story?
Well, I think our best guess here toward the beginning of May at this point is we're going to see a gradual reopening in many places in May and in June. And we're going to live in this society maybe for a year that is partially open, but that commerce comes back and is not closed down.
Yeah.
Essentially, what that's going to mean is that most of the second quarter is going to be a real loss for those that depend on advertising. If you depend on advertising, It's a deep problem. But it's one quarter. After that, as much as 20% of print advertising may never come back. So you're seeing a permanent ratcheting down of the print industry. I don't think we'll see similar kind of permanent ratcheting down in public radio with underwriting, but that's because these trends of, for instance, the preprint advertising, the Best Buys and big box store advertising you see in a Sunday paper, the inserts, those have been going away, and now they're going to go away faster. So we're going to see both trends. It is one of those things where you're going to see the independents, if they have enough financial capacity, being able to make a better argument. And people say, oh, now I see it even more clearly of your value. At the same time, when I have to write about the continuing consolidation of the newspaper industry, which is not my favorite, but I feel compelled to cover it, we could well be at a point by the end of this year where one or two financial firms, essentially PE firms, control as much as half of the daily circulation in the country. Wow. Because what they're doing is they're looking at this and saying, yep, this business is going down, but there's still enough free cash flow or profits in it that if you push it all together and you keep on cutting, there's still a lot of money to be made on the way down. So that's true at the same time that we're seeing public-spirited independents trying to make a way forward. And so we're going to continue to have that battle. COVID essentially says to everybody, it's going to be tougher. It's no doubt it's going to be tougher. And whatever your model is, whether you're a hedge fund or a public-spirited nonprofit, you better have financial capacity, because you need to buy more time in a business that is still transitioning.
You call this the question of the hour. Once the dust settles, once we're all back in some kind of normal routine again, how much, and I'll put it as you put it in your piece, just how much factually reported local news will Americans be able to get?
Yeah.
What do you figure the answer is looking at it now as you're scanning the horizon?
I have to put my optimism aside and my journalism realism hat on, and the simple answer is less. They've been getting a lot less. We didn't really have any kind of plateau of stability, but now we're seeing a steeper decline. So it is going to decline even further. It's declining every week. We're seeing not just furloughs, meaning that people would be called back at some point, but we're seeing more layoffs, where people won't be called back. So the problem that we've had is deepening. In digital business a lot, we talk about metrics. You can measure everything. And in a way, and it's somewhat hyperbolic, but I've said, there's only one metric that counts, which is how much high quality original local news reporting is getting out there in your community, however it gets out there. Work back from that. If you can do that and see, what we want to see is an increasing level of good original news reporting, and best from a variety of voices, not just one, but wherever it comes from. If you can do that, then you figure out, you back up from there to what is the business model that supports it.
All right. Let me finally have you come back to your optimistic strain that you're inclined to sometimes.
You.
Okay. And that, I'll ask you this finally, to the question of whether we can withstand the threat on journalism. You do seem optimistic, at least in the sense that you say we have the ability as human beings, we're naturally adaptable, we're adaptable. I guess you're saying we can figure this out.
Absolutely. And in fact, it has been figured out. It is being figured out. We need more people working on it. We need more money in the system, but it has been figured out. We can no longer say in 2020, well, as some publishers still like to say, well, no one's figured it out. No, that's not true. Not just the New York Times. And Boston Globe is a regional paper. It has 155,000 digital subscriptions, which is the same number of Sunday print copies it now publishes. We could see some paper as venerable as the Boston Globe keep a big, experienced newsroom and be, say, Sunday print and digital throughout the week and be stable and actually more profitable. So it's out there, but we need staying power, we need capital, and we need talent in this profession. We need the ability to hire especially smart younger people who have the skills that are needed, both digital and journalistic overall. But it's out there. And so that's where the optimism comes from, is this is not a problem that is unsolvable or hasn't been solved. It's a matter of application or innovation rather than invention.
Ken Doctor, his book is Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News. He also runs the book's companion website, newsonomics.com. Joining us now is Penelope Muse Abernathy, a former executive at The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. These days, she's the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina. And Abernathy's research has shown that over the past 15 years, the United States has lost a fourth of its local newspapers. And we've lost more than half of the journalists of those surviving papers. So that's where we began. What does this mean for communities across the country?
There are two ways we've lost news. One is we've lost newspapers. We've lost 2,100 newspapers over the last 15 years. Of those, 2,000 have been weeklies or non-dailies, most of them small. So when you lose a newspaper in a small and mid-sized community, that means there's no one to show up to cover the school board meeting, the county commissioner meeting, or the planning board meeting. So you've really lost the reporter that covered the news, the very local news at the very local level. When you lose journalists, most of the journalists that we have lost have come off of the state and metro papers. So what you're losing there are the journalists that covered the big topic issues, the issues around education or environment or health or governance or politics that kind of bound us together as a region and as a state and kind of helped us fixate on what the big issues were that we needed to address. And so we've lost that, and we've lost a majority of the major investigative reporting that we used to look to, the ones that held local officials and state officials accountable, passed legislation at both the state and even the national level, and also exposed corruption in both business and government.
What happens, Penny, when a news organization, just take an average small town, in broad terms, what happens to the kind of social fabric of a place, or even the kind of the ecosystem of a place, when a news organization goes away in a place? What happens?
Well, research has shown that really good newspapers are both community builders and they're problem solvers. So let me explain. There are three things that economists, sociologists, political scientists, as well as journalists agree on, and that is that first, newspapers help us identify the really important issues that we need to make wise decisions on. And the second thing they do is they, as a rule, they encourage economic development. So they, on the most basic level, their advertising in the past has put consumers together with local businesses. But even more importantly, as you think about it, investigative reporting that surfaces long-term issues is going to help you do the same thing, because it may not be popular, but it forces you to look at what problems you need to solve. And then thirdly, and very importantly, for especially small towns and communities, even in inner cities and suburbs, it gives you a sense of social identity and geographic identity. We vote in terms of where we live geographically. We tend to have the same problems that our neighbors have, as well as we often have problems that people that are three or four counties over are sharing too. So newspapers, as in the best of sense, they give us a real notion of cohesiveness and also point the way to how we can solve those problems in the future.
It's not just about news.
It's about history. It's about capturing everyday life. It's about, and it is also about introducing us to people we didn't even know before. Hmm.
You tell the story of your hometown in North Carolina. There was this case not so long ago of election fraud there, and it deprived residents for, I think it was almost a year, of a representative in the House of Representatives. Tell a little bit about that story, because that seems to illustrate what we're talking about.
Thanks for asking. This occurred in the North Carolina 9th Congressional District, which stretches from the suburbs of Charlotte in the western part of the state all the way over to the eastern part of the state around the suburbs of Fayetteville and Fort Bragg and runs through five of the poorest counties in the state. And essentially what happened is someone decided to commit election fraud. He collected a group of absentee ballots, filled them in himself, basically in favor of the Republican candidate. Now, what was disturbing about all of that is that it wasn't a reporter who came across it at either the state or the local papers. It was actually a college professor about 150 miles away who happened to be looking at state election returns 2 weeks later, who discovered that a county that was predominantly Republican had come in heavily for predominantly Democrat had come in heavily for the Republican candidate on the absentee ballots. It's the kind of thing that can happen when you do not have a strong local paper who might have come across that, or even a strong regional or metro paper who would in the past have had many reporters out looking, roaming through the eastern part of the state.
Do we have any studies, any figures that shows that corruption goes up when journalists leave a community? Any particulars, any metrics that we can see?
Well, everyone looks for the corruption measure. Let me back up. I think there are many other studies that have done, many of them very recently, that show two or three other things. One, just losing a local newspaper often increases the price on taxes that you and I pay, because without just the transparency and the oversight that comes from somebody showing up at a routine government meeting, a study out of Illinois showed last year that the cost of doing business goes up. We end up paying more in terms of basis points for the bonds that are issued by a town. There are studies that have shown that voter participation goes way down, especially in off-year elections. And part of that problem is you can't get any information. And that was one of the problems in the North Carolina 9th Congressional District. There was just no information to be had at any of the local papers. And then when you hit the paywall on some of the metro papers, so we were forced to either decide to have a yearly subscription or to try to look elsewhere for some of the information. So when we think about corruption, yes, there are instances where we can point to for specific corruption. We can point to papers that have taken courageous stands on corruption that are no longer here. There was many of those who worked for the Youngstown Vindicator, which closed earlier this year, talked about the strong stand on corruption that paper had taken over the years, with everything from city government to the businesses in the area. So who's going to do that now? Who's going to be the one that's very aggressive in going to make sure meetings are open, going to hire the lawyer that forces open meetings or forces government to turn over records? Those are the kind of things that ultimately lead to corruption, but start by just us not having transparency.
You have said that the local news organizations that are going to be able to survive all of this are going to be led by journalistic entrepreneurs who are both creative, you say, and have a disciplined strategy. What are the strategies, as you look at all of this, that seem to be the way forward that might work?
Well, let me start with this. The successful news organization, regardless of whether it's a newspaper or a digital outlet or a radio station, is going to look to serve the needs and expectations of both its residents or audiences and its business. There just aren't enough residents in many of these communities that are willing to pay enough and have enough money to pay. So, you know, it is one of those things where you need to think about investing in the value that you offer to your community. So investment to me in your unique value is investing in your journalism and investing in your sales and marketing capabilities that can help commerce in your area.
You say instead of one business model that works for most, We need to have many.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think there are going to be for-profit models and there are going to be non-profit models. And I'm also suggesting that we may even need to look at public funding, more public funding, especially in economically struggling communities. Based on the research that I've done with small and mid-sized news organizations, I'm convinced that if you have a smart, creative, and disciplined owner/publisher of a newspaper, you can create both a for-profit and a nonprofit model if your organization is located in a community that has at least average or above average growth prospects in terms of population and also economic growth prospects. Where I worry the most are the economically struggling communities that have lost newspapers. And by the way, our data shows that communities that have lost newspapers tend to be much poorer than the newspaper average. So these are the very communities that need the kind of information and news that will help residents in that area make wise decisions that are going to affect not only their lives, but future lives. So we need to start thinking very creatively at the policy level, at both state and national levels, about how we get news back into those, the second America, as I might call it, the one that has been kind of bypassed by the technological revolution, by the internet revolution and the information age. And that includes inner city neighborhoods, that includes suburbs on the outside of aging manufacturing cities, and it includes rural flyover areas.
So if the health of a local economy is one of the important elements here, how do you factor into the equation now the seeming coming depression because of the coronavirus? What's that going to do to the picture?
Well, I think we need to, as Ken pointed out, there are really two things that have gone on here. One has been the depletion of all print advertising and an inability for newspapers, especially in these small and mid-sized towns, to be able to grab a significant portion of the digital ad revenue, which has primarily gone to Facebook and Google. But the secondary point that gets missed by many if you're looking from the top down instead of the bottom up is that 2008 was deadly for many of the small and mid-sized newspapers. In fact, most of the ones we've lost after that. And why is that? It's because Wall Street affected Main Street. And so as I've talked to publishers, especially those in small and mid-sized communities, what they're trying to calculate is how many of the businesses that have been shut down will ever come back. That is going to affect the amount of revenue that they get from those businesses. And quite frankly, for many small and mid-sized newspapers, they still depend on quite a bit of revenue from advertisers and don't have the option of turning to subscribers. So I think that what we've got in a situation right now, as Ken pointed out, there is an issue about money and there is an issue about time.
Let me ask you this finally, Penny. You mentioned that this is going to take a community effort. It's going to take a community of individuals and institutions working together
right,
to sort all of this out. So I guess that's what I wanted to ask. Do you have faith in readers and listeners and news consumers to step in and provide, you know, step into the breach when advertising is falling short? Do you have faith that that could happen?
I think what we have been dealing with over the last 15 years is kind of the story of the slowly boiling water with the frog in it. And I think that what coronavirus has caused us to do is pause for a moment and appreciate what not having local news is will mean to us. What's at stake for this democracy and what's at stake for society? I'm hoping this really convinces people to understand what is at stake, to think about the ways that they can support, to think, to get foundations, to think about how they allocate enough money for local news, consider it an institutional, cultural institution in the same way they consider the arts that they give to or our social justice programs. I mean, if we lose the news, we lose our contact with the society as we know it today and with the democracy of our future.
That's Penelope Abernathy. She's the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina. Abernathy's research inspired the New Yorker staff writer Charles Bethay to travel to Jones County, North Carolina recently. He wanted to see for himself what happens to a community when the news is gone. Go to our website to listen to our conversation with Bethay. It's radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.